From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I urge you to subscribe to the podcast. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, and several of you have, I say thank you, thank you, thank you. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. We're in the middle of the High Holy Days on the Jewish calendar. Let me extend our warmest greetings to everyone who is observing this sacred time. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics, one of the highlights of the political religious rights busy calendar is the annual Values Voters Summit this weekend in Washington, D.C. As the merger between these theocratic forces and the administration continues apace, it's not surprising that Donald Trump will be speaking to the gathering on October 12th. Meanwhile, almost 100 Christian faith leaders associated with the Red Letter Christian movement are calling for a National Day of Prayer this Sunday, quote, for the truth to be revealed through the impeachment inquiry. And once again, Vice President Pence is feigning ignorance when it comes to his involvement in an international scandal. The same man who was charged with vetting now disgraced National Security Advisor Michael Flynn and has perfected the "who me" facial expression is now claiming that the self-serving, crassly political demands Donald Trump made of Ukraine's new president were all news to him. And finally, to Germany, where our producer makes his home. It was the holiest day of the Jewish calendar, Yom Kippur. This week, in the small eastern German city Halle, it was the day a 27-year-old Holocaust-denying nationalist gunned down two people outside the local synagogue. The nation has responded with grief and anger. Most Germans carry the Holocaust in a very personal and reverent way, but this one didn't. Most synagogues are permanently under police protection, especially during times of prayer. This one wasn't. The gunman, armed with an automatic rifle, approached the building but couldn't get in. If it were not for that obstacle, it is unthinkable what could have been the likely outcome. Because, you see, there were as many as 80 Jews inside that synagogue. We grieve for the precious lives lost on Wednesday in Germany. We pray that the double scourge of supremacism and firearms does not spread further across the globe. And we hope that some lessons are learned from the ever-growing number of bias attacks in a numb and angry world. Coming up this week on State of Belief Radio, two distinct but critically important conversations about the forces shaping the times we're living in. As manufactured divisions continue to rend our nation, pitting neighbor against neighbor, and as artificial loyalties grow ever more entrenched and unrelenting call for a different and more positive approach continues to grow in volume and reach. We've highlighted the critically important work of the One America movement on this show several times before. But as the urgency of the mission to bring Americans together again continues to increase, we'll have director Andrew Hanauer back on the show with an update. But first, another kind of campaign that is influencing many aspects of life in America and beyond right now. The political religious right has been notorious for standing with Donald Trump no matter what he has said and done since taking the Oval Office. We've highlighted the unconscionably political messaging from presidential cheerleader Pastor Robert Jeffries, who overtly ridicules any religious integrity belonging to any but his own theocratic ilk, from apple far from the tree evangelist Franklin Graham, who has gone so far as to embark on a multi-state Decision America tour, evoking his late father's public appearances while galvanizing white Christian opposition to impeachment as illegitimate, partisan, and even anti-Christian. Many others are dropping all pretense of moral leadership and respect for the Constitution in the service of this beleaguered president. For their followers, disturbed by the direction the nation has taken, it's a comforting balm to soothe awakened consciences. But it is painfully important to remember that down through history, ostensibly, religious leaders have offered cover for not only misguided policies, but even genocidal ones. And as tensions continue to mount here at home, there are few forces more urgent to carefully analyze. Now, to help us do just that, I am very grateful to be joined by a man who was born into the highest levels of evangelical leadership and carried that mantle for decades before a profound and prayerful change of heart not only moved him out of that role, but led him to devote the rest of his life to, in his own words, undoing some of the damage he now believes his ministry helped cause. With those brave and humble words, Frank Schaefer, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you. Thanks for having me back.
I know some of the evangelical leaders so relentlessly attacking the president's critics right now, but you know them far better, and you may understand this movement better than anyone alive. When you hear them say something, anything to defend Donald Trump, what are they actually thinking?
Well, you know, sitting as a 67-year-old father of three grown children and five grandchildren who looks back over the path that the religious right took since the 70s and 80s when my dad was a star, Francis Schaefer, in the religious right, along with those such as Jerry Falwell, Pat Robertson, teamed up with Dr. Sievert Koop to start what amounted to the Protestant evangelical wing of the anti-abortion movement, which then morphed into the litmus test that shaped the modern Republican Party that finally gave us Donald Trump. My perspective is a personal one as well as one of someone who reads and looks at history. And from that perspective, I mark this moment as we talk as a day when small Kurdish and Christian Syriac churches are burning in northern Syria, bombed by an Islamic fanatic, Erdogan of Turkey, given permission to level this community that has worn the American flag on their uniforms as they stood shoulder to shoulder with American soldiers and Marines in the Middle East, all because Donald Trump has a business interest in Turkey and didn't want to offend Erdogan. Now, I bring this up because of the fact that so many people in the media talk about the secular hypocrisy of Trump as he comes as this liberal Democrat, now newfound Republican, true faithful person who is against abortion and so forth and pays off porn stars. But there's a far greater hypocrisy afoot today than Donald Trump or the Christians that follow him. And that's in the evangelical leadership that I knew personally, those such as Franklin Graham, Ralph Reed, who's just publishing a book right now as this program goes out, calling it the moral responsibility of anyone who is a Christian to back Donald Trump in the 2020 election. And the fact is that as of today, with the exception of Pat Robertson, who said that it was a mistake for Trump to give the green light to Erdogan to begin a new genocidal pogrom against the Kurdish people, but he said the mandate of heaven may be lost by Trump. That was as far as he would go. The evangelical leadership has closed ranks again and again and again with Donald Trump, dismissing everything from his taped interview where he talks about grabbing a woman by the genitals without her permission and laughs it off, all the way through to this morning as our allies in the Middle East are being pounded by Turkish forces. None of this has resulted in them bailing or calling him out. So you have to look for a different answer than mere theology or politics. And I'll just say it in a word. Evangelical white Christianity in the United States has disappeared and given way to a personality cult, the likes of which has never been seen in American politics in our history, that is religion-driven, but abides by none of the rules of the religion that drives it. And so that tells you something. This is not even pretending any longer to be a Christ-based denominational kind of thrust or cult or group, even built around one big figure in a mega church. This has gone to the next step, and that is, without any hyperbole whatsoever, I believe, stepped into the place of the German evangelical Lutheran Church and the Roman Catholic Church, 99% of which went along with Hitler in the 1920s and 30s, up into the World War and the Holocaust without repenting until after the war. So in Germany, a few figures like Dietrich Bonhoeffer stood up. In America, none have, in terms of the big-time establishment evangelical figures like Jerry Falwell Jr., who makes excuses after excuse after excuse for this corrupt president, while he himself, Jerry Falwell Jr., that is caught in exactly the same kind of nepotistic, self-dealing family with him profiting off this so-called nonprofit university he runs. So when you look at it, I just say again, we're not talking about evangelical white Christianity. We are talking about a personality cult that has replaced it and is much more similar to something like the personality cult that developed around Mao Zedong and his little red book that led to the Cultural Revolution in China and the millions of deaths there than it is to any phenomena American politics has seen, good, bad, or ugly. And that's the situation we're in. And I'm talking about this as someone who sadly, tragically, helped lay the groundwork for this with my father, Francis Schaeffer, in the 70s and 80s, as we helped with people like Ronald Reagan, Jack Kemp, President Ford, and others, weld the evangelical movement into party politics. That's the part our family played. And of course, today, I look at this with absolute horror. So that's a long thumbnail sketch, but I think what I've told you is accurate.
I know the leaders of that whole movement would not agree with you. They wouldn't say that you gave an accurate description of who they are and what they're doing. What would be their defensive argument at that point?
Well, let's start with the truth about this, the movement's leaders. I'm not talking about every individual within the white evangelical community, but let's just look at Franklin Graham, Ralph Reed, and Jerry Falwell Jr. as three individuals. Ralph Reed narrowly escaped going to prison for a fiasco that he was involved with, lying and self-dealing about the casino industry. Seems like that's a long way from anything Christian. Jerry Falwell Jr. has made a multi-million dollar personal family fortune out of supposedly a nonprofit university where he has lent money, according to reports in Politico and other places, to family friends, set up businesses, and then allowed them to get, in one case, a $130 million construction contract from a university that now has dissenting board members describing it as an ongoing Falwell family real estate deal. Franklin Graham Jr., when you add up all his perks, salary, the plane, the properties the Graham organization owns and so forth around the country, is probably pulling in somewhere between $4 and $6 million a year personally with his family, and in addition to which has completely sold out the Graham ministry reputation to an anti-Muslim, homophobic agenda, and completely bought into access to power through Donald Trump. So the truth of the matter is, the big leaders involved in this sort of evangelical white voter takeover of the Trump party, as you'd have to call the Republicans these days, is driven by men who, by the standards of evangelicalism itself, say 50 years ago, in terms of what was licit and illicit, would all now be dismissed as the kind of con artists that, for instance, people like Oral Roberts were dismissed as by mainstream evangelicals back in the day. Self-dealing, grandiose people who were very much in bed with a corruption of a kind that can only be described as con artists or Ponzi schemes, this type of thing. That's where we've gone. So these are not folks who somehow have fallen into a trap and been misled or are doing it because of the goodness of their own heart. They want access to the power and they want access to the fundraising machinery that comes with keeping your followers completely riled up all of the time on issues like abortion, gay rights, transgender rights, and so forth. But in terms of the major leadership, these are not sincere people with whom to have disagreements. So for someone like myself, when I look at them saying, oh, I would disagree with this view of me, it's like Bernie Madoff saying, I disagree with the view of me that says I'm a con artist. Well, fine, but you're in prison. And so should these people be. And their tax deductible status should have been long gone, and they should be prosecuted for fraud in the case of many of these people and their families. And they are one and the same with the self-dealing Trump clan. That's where we're at. So when it gets to the big issues of politics, you have another issue going along with it, which is the same kind of corruption at the top echelons of the so-called Christian world, which is now a Trump cult, as you have in the Trump family itself. There's a weird symbiotic mirror image to this of Trump building towers in Turkey and getting into bed with an Islamist extremist like Erdogan, who is oppressing his own people, putting university professors in jail by the score, et cetera, journalists disappearing and all the rest of it, and what's going on in the evangelical community. So let's just take off the blinkers, stop being polite, tell it like it is. We are in the hands of a corrupt group of people. And the fact that the Republican Party has utterly become the enablers of this gang is just shocking. Far more shocking than Trump and the evangelical white voter is that the Republican Senate and the congressmen that remain from, for instance, the Tea Party that had some ideals, however much one disagreed with them, have now totally sold out to become his enablers. And this is just absolutely the bottom of the pit as far as American history goes.
Frank, one of the things that frightens me, maybe even more than how easily conservatives seem to buy into any imagination-stretching argument made by leaders of the political religious right, is how dismissive most other Americans are of how pervasive and powerful the theocrats have become in our government and culture. Why do you think more progressive people just can't seem to see what's happening and continue to see Christians' first movements as fringe, even as the rights of everyone else keep getting chipped away in the name of religious freedom?
The reason the secular folks, or we could say the secular left, or the liberals, or you know, more enlightened people, the university crowd, the East Coast and West Coast media crowd, don't seem to get the danger posed by the theocrats, the theocracy movement in this country, represented by people like Franklin Graham, is because they live in a different hermetically sealed online universe that was hermetically sealed before. And I'll just give you one example. You know, the New York Times for years has had a society section, a science section, all kinds of various sections, areas dedicated to it. They've never had a religion page in the history of the newspaper, and Newsweek got rid of their religion page when it was still a viable going concern big time magazine back 25, 30 years ago. the bestseller list of evangelical books are not counted in the New York Times as legitimate, and therefore they're off the radar screen. If your average reader of the New York Times, Washington Post, Los Angeles Times, what used to be Time and Newsweek, your watcher of network news or cable news or online digital news, et cetera, had any idea of the scope and the money involved in the evangelical subculture, their jaws would drop, even when it comes to the number of books sold, which routinely are more than what is reported in the secular bookstores, with a few exceptions of things like the Harry Potter series. The evangelical books have outsold them. So, first of all, it's just simple ignorance of a massive public, because their media representatives, their people who should be trying to explain the world around them, have just not known how to deal with this phenomenon and therefore have ignored it until the election of Donald Trump, when they started scrambling around trying to talk about Rust Belt jobs and Appalachia and all the rest of it, still missing the point that his most bedrock support is the white evangelical voter who goes to church every Sunday and is told that the world is evil, that you can't believe science, that climate change is not occurring, that probably the worst thing that ever happened in the community was integration in the 50s and 60s, although it's not spoken out loud. All these almost all white Christian schools are witness to that fact. And that this subculture, which homeschools its children and sends them to Christian colleges to be kept away from the world, i.e. away from science and any contradictory facts, now was perfectly right to be cherry-picked by the first person that came along that echoed their paranoid fantasies and conspiracy theories that are summed up in the word fake news, which perfectly mirrors this evangelical, quote-unquote, biblical view of the entire scientific enterprise of the last 500 years, 600 years since the Renaissance. It's all fake news. So when you look at this phenomena, you have to see that the evangelicals live in a hermetically sealed bubble where facts don't apply. I'll give you an example. How do you argue with anything Donald Trump has done once you've established in your own brain that no matter what he does, God has put him in the position he's in to save America from godless Democrats, homosexuals, et cetera? There's no arguing with that when you've deified this position. Well, similarly, there's no arguing with them when it comes to what he's doing somewhere else, whether it's in Turkey or giving tax breaks to billionaires or whether it's any other of the fraudulent enterprises his family's involved in. When it becomes a matter of theological belief, which is what these evangelical leaders like Franklin Graham, Ralph Reed, Jerry Falwell Jr. have done, they've made this a matter of faith. When that takes hold and takes root in a political form, coming back with secular or scientific or rational arguments is never going to do it. This movement cannot be defeated with rational argument because it's outside the bubble where rational discourse means anything. It can only be defeated at the ballot box. And that is why you have everything from gerrymandering to voter suppression and all the rest as now a prime tactic of the Republican Party, because demographically they know they're losing the argument, but they are delaying the, quote, takeover of our country by brown people, black people, women, gay people, alien forces as they regard them, by simply moving it down the road a little bit. And Donald Trump, with his authoritarian approach of saying, I don't care what the Democratic procedures are for impeachment, I don't care what a subpoena means, I don't care what it means that every other president since 1947 or whenever it is has turned over their tax returns in a timely way, I'm not doing it. This total stonewalling and blocking the system is fine with them because they regard themselves, they being these Trump cultist evangelicals, as outside the system anyway from birth. Hey, their moms told them if they did have to go to a public school instead of being homeschooled, don't believe what the teacher tells you in the biology class. Evolution never happened. They don't believe it. Don't believe that women should have choice. Don't believe that gay people don't choose that lifestyle in some craven manner to be sinful, but are born that way. That's not true. Believe our version. When you're raised on this from birth, you become a kind of a fifth column that is a citizen technically, but literally lives outside of your own country while being within it. And since the secular community has not paid attention, they have no clue of this, or hadn't until this 82%, 83% of the white evangelical vote backed Trump up. That got their attention. But they still don't get that what's driving it is not politics, but religion. That's where they refuse to admit where they live. Because I guess that would spoil the self-image of enlightened liberal East Coast, West Coast folks who then look at it and say, well, gee, maybe this isn't the country that we have real power in. Maybe we're not as quite what we think we are in terms of elites pulling the strings in the university community and so forth. If we were, how could this be happening? And of course, the answer is to them, listen, you guys have done a lousy job educating our people. You've done a lousy job in terms of our public schools. You've allowed things to slide to the point where people have so little knowledge of the world that when Donald Trump stands up and says the Kurds are not our allies because they didn't help us in D-Day, he isn't just laughed off the podium by everyone who hears it, from working class people on down or on up, however you see it. Because our common knowledge, our education levels, what we know about the world and how it works is so pitiful now in terms of the general online addicted population that he can say anything and 30, 40, 50% of Americans don't even have a base of factual knowledge in history or science or literature or anything else to hear the ridiculousness of it because they themselves are totally uneducated people.
Let's say the impeachment goes forward. This week, a Fox News poll found 51% of Americans now supporting this president's removal from office. In all sincerity, how extreme might the actions the political religious right encourage and excuse among its constituency become?
It will become very extreme. Just remember that Trump's more deranged followers armed with AR-15s and all the rest of it have been listening to him from the beginning. And they have been training and buying ammunition and all the rest. And you've got people like Jeffress saying there'll be a civil war, Trump calling people who go up against him treasonous or traitors or spies. So the language is all there to encourage the unhinged. And the crime here is that the evangelical leadership is not stepping forth and quelling this before it starts and denouncing Trump for his racism. And so they bear some responsibility for those Jews who were shot down in their synagogue. And they bear some responsibility for the Hispanic people gunned down. But that's nothing compared to what you will see if he loses the next election and or is impeached. It isn't going to be an organized effort by Jeffress of his congregation marches out of their church 10,000 strong and starts shooting up police stations. It's going to be lone individuals, but there'll be a lot of them. And I make a prediction, and that is there'll be more and more political spin to the mass shootings as he'd become the staple of American life that we're all, quote, so used to already without having done anything about the NRA and gun lobby. The next shoe to drop is that a lot of these shootings are going to have the same political tinge that they did in El Paso or in Pittsburgh, except next time around it's going to be aimed at political operatives and people in Congress and the Senate and those who have, quote, unquote, betrayed Trump. And I think that will be happening if he loses or is impeached. It won't be a concerted, organized action, but it will happen because evangelical leaders like Franklin Graham, Ralph Reed, and Jerry Falwell Jr. went along with him so far, even after his incendiary language, that it's given the green light to some of their more deranged, fact-free followers.
Frank Schaefer spent years in the family business as a prominent public evangelist before turning away from that work. An incisive thinker and articulate writer, Frank is much in demand as a public speaker who has authored numerous best-selling books, including Why I Am an Atheist Who Believes in God, How to Give Love, Create Beauty, and Find Peace, and Crazy for God, How I Grew Up as One of the Elect, Helped Found the Religious Right, and Lived to Take All, or Almost All of It, Back. Frank's latest book is titled Letter to Lucy, A Manifesto of Creative Redemption in the Age of Trump, Fascism, and Lies. Frank, in this time of spin and confusion, I can't tell you how highly I value your integrity and insights. Thank you so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
We'll take a 180-degree turn in topic when we come back. Brazenly aspiring to bring a fractured nation back together again, Andrew Hanauer is the director of the One America Movement. Now, if you miss any part of today's program, don't panic. You can hear full episodes of State of Belief anytime on our website, You'll also find links to the topics we discussed this week, extended interviews and transcripts, and an archive of past shows, all of that at stateofbelief.com. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, religion and radio done differently. We first introduced you to activist Andrew Hanauer when he was just launching the ambitious One America movement. Well, it's been a few years now, and even though some rifts in our nation have grown dramatically deeper, the movement to repair these rifts is thankfully growing as well. For an update, I am grateful to welcome Andrew Hanauer back to State of Belief Radio. Andy, thank you so much for being with us again.
Thanks so much for having me.
I know there have been some exciting new developments recently in the life of the organization, so I want to start there. I'd like to have you tell us about the update, the progress that's going on with you.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I mean, I think that the main thing is that I think there's really a growing recognition in our country that winning our partisan battles, as important as those can be, is not going to ultimately get us where we want to go. That if we don't do something about the divisions in our country and the dynamics that are tearing the fabric of our country apart, we're not going to end up in a place that's really good for anybody. So to that end, I think, you know, our organization has been growing. We when we were just starting off, we were just one staffer. We're now up to five, so that's great. We have just become an independent nonprofit. After being part of a larger nonprofit as we sort of got off the ground. And we are we just launched our own website about a month ago. So things are moving.
So how does all of this help multiply the impact of your work on the nation?
Yeah, so, you know, I think for us, we've really been focused for the last 2 years on learning. You know, I think it's really important that if we're going to do anything as a nonprofit, as a charity, that we understand what it is we're doing. How does it work? Does it actually help? Is it making a difference? Is it effective? So we really resisted for 2 years efforts to encourage us to scale beyond where we were, efforts to get our projects in front of TV cameras. We really felt it was important to spend 2 years understanding how to do this work the right way and building trust across some of these really deep divides in communities around the country. So now I think we're at a place where we've really learned a lot about how to bring people together and how not to bring people together. And I think at that point, at the stage we're at now, we're really at a place where we're able to launch and scale and bring this work to more people and get it into the news more and so forth. So, you know, going independent, launching our own website, those are steps that are part of that process of saying, you know, we've done our homework and we're going to continue to do our homework, but we're ready to move on to the next level.
You know, it's unusual to hear someone say we've been spending 2 years listening. Though that's wise, and what you were learning. I'm just curious, what did you hear, and how did that translate to what you learned?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the things that we realized very quickly was that we could not accomplish this work by showing up, doing an event, and leaving. That when you bring people into relationship with each other, who have not been in relationship before, who really have been viewed each other as being part of, you know, differing teams. There's some huge trust gaps there that you have to really work at to overcome, and that takes time. And, you know, our work is about bringing people together to address local issues in their community, right? We don't have Democrats and Republicans sitting across a table having conversations about national political issues as a first step. We really have our participants are doing work in the community. And the reality is when you start to work on an issue, you realize very quickly that you're not going to solve it in 6 months.
Yeah.
You're certainly not going to solve it in one event. And so as we really, you know, we really came to a place where it became clear, if we actually mean what we say, that we are here to bring people together to accomplish something, well, then we certainly can't leave until that thing has been accomplished and until those relationships have been formed. And so there just became a very clear indicator to us early on that there are no shortcuts in this work.
Yeah.
And that we can't take them.
Well, you know, that's a lot of wisdom in what you've just said, because all too often national or international initiatives can seem too abstract and far away mm-hmm. to truly connect with. That's why the state and local level work the One America Movement is doing, I think that's why it is so important. And would you talk about maybe three or four of those kinds of projects that fit what we're talking about?
Yeah, I'd be happy to. So our faith leaders in Houston, from very different backgrounds, you know, Southern Baptist, Muslim, Jewish, et cetera, have been working together for a year and a half now. First, just getting to know each other, and now over the last 6 months have been doing projects around Houston to help do recovery from Hurricane Harvey. And next week, they will be traveling together to Puerto Rico, where they will do work around Hurricane Maria relief. Mm-hmm. In West Virginia, we continue to bring together, Southern Baptist Evangelical Church in West Virginia with a large synagogue and a large mosque in the D.C. area to address the opioid epidemic together in West Virginia's Eastern Panhandle. Mm-hmm. That's one of the most important projects that we do. In Tulsa, we are just getting off the ground on a project that we think will be really, I think, impactful around acknowledging the 100-year anniversary of the really not a race riot, but a race massacre that happened mm-hmm. Against the African-American community back in 1921. Acknowledging the anniversary, but also doing work between very different groups that helps do something positive moving forward and not just having a ceremony. So those are some examples of the work that we're doing.
Oh, great examples. Is there one particular undertaking that has you the most excited, particularly in terms of its potential going forward?
Yeah, I mean, I think the work in West Virginia is really critical. One of the things that we keep hearing from people is that they simply don't even know anybody who has different beliefs, drastically different beliefs than they do. And the solution to that is not to, read other people's social media feeds where we see some of the worst of what all of us have to offer. We have to get out of our, not just our bubbles, but our sort of ways of thinking, our own heads, our own patterns, and go out and experience something really different. And I think connecting, the Washington, D.C. area, the city where, president got 4% of the vote, with a much more conservative, more rural community that's only an hour away, has been a really profoundly important aspect of the work that we're doing. And I think it's been really meaningful to the participants.
When you started out on this journey, did you have any idea how much more critically important this work would become than it was when you started?
I thought, like anyone, I didn't know how these last few years would go. I think certainly whatever somebody thinks about the president. I think we can all agree that he's fairly unconventional as far as presidents go. And I think there was always some, you know, uncertainty about how these dynamics would play out in regards to his presidency. But that said, the patterns that we've been seeing started before the president ran for office. And I think the experts that we work with, the neuroscientists, social scientists, people who have done this work in other countries around the world, who are now working here because they see these signs that they've seen in other countries, they were worried before 2015. They became increasingly worried by 2016. And I think none of them really believed that things were just going to magically get better starting in 2017. So to that end, I think we're seeing the continuation of a really dangerous pattern that's been going on for a long time now, and that we need to do something about.
What are some of those dangerous patterns?
So I think polarization needs to be understood as part of a process by which societies move from a healthy democratic society to much more dangerous outcomes. And along the way of that process, there are tipping points, warning signs that we should be aware of, that experts who have done this work around the world have recognized as really worrisome. One of those is when our polarization begins to become more about identity and less about ideology. In other words, over the past 30, 40 years, Americans haven't really changed their political beliefs much in terms of how far apart they are on crucial issues, but we hate each other a lot more. In fact, there's a lot of studies that have come out that show that when Americans think about the other side, they are thinking about very specific groups of people that they don't like. And when you tell them that those groups of people actually make up a smaller percentage of the other side than they expected, they begin to reduce their negative feelings toward the other side. So it's become, as I think Jonathan Haidt said it in the New York Times, it's become less "I disagree with you" and more "I hate your stupid face." And that's really dangerous, because you can't negotiate your identity. You can negotiate a political belief, and you can compromise on policy solutions, but you can't change who you are in that sense. The other tipping point, warning sign, I think that's really important, is when all of who we are, all of our identity, increasingly becomes wrapped up into one of two teams. So it doesn't matter if you're pro-life or you're pro-choice or you're Jewish or you're a sister or a father or a sports fan. At a certain point in a really dangerous society, it just becomes, yeah, but which team are you on? And we're seeing this with Brexit in the UK. We're certainly seeing it with the president here in the United States. It was a deliberate strategy in Rwanda. It's been a deliberate strategy in other countries to basically cleave society into two sides. And then what's really critical to understand is that at that stage, regardless of which side is more moral in somebody's opinion, just the dynamic of having the two sides creates a feedback loop where the two sides become farther and farther apart. It pushes us into a deeper and deeper entrenchment. And so when you get to that stage, that's a really dangerous place to be. So a big part of what One America is trying to do is create that, keep that connective tissue alive, right? So you may be this, I may be that, but we're both part of this other thing. We're both part of this third team, the pro, you know, fixing the school up in our local neighborhood team. Because that connective tissue is part of how you keep the two teams from sliding farther and farther apart.
You have mentioned, Andy, some of the various religious groups that you've worked with. Would you talk about the religious components of the movement, how you engage with diverse people of faith, and why that's such an important part of your work?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think for us, you know, we believe that this country is for everybody. And that's true no matter what faith you are. It's also true whether or not you belong to a religious community or not, or believe in God or not. I think what we think is that faith is a critical part of who we are, in part because it's who we are, it's who our leadership is, it's what we believe. But it's also because our country needs something different right now. We need something that's values driven. We need something that is calling us to something higher than just being part of a winning political team or tribe. We need to bridge these divides. We need to be able to have different kinds of conversations, right? It can't be, here are my talking points, here are your talking points, let's argue them out. We need to be taking a step back. What kind of country do we want? What are the values that animate, you know, that conversation, that define how we feel about the world? I think faith is not the only vehicle for that, but I think faith is a great sort of transcendent force that really should be much, much bigger than our political views and our political tribes. So it really animates everything that we do in that sense.
I sincerely think there is no shortage of well-intentioned people in this country, people who are hurting at what they see happening and who have a distinctly different vision of America from that of this administration. But I think far more rare is that shift in thinking from outrage to action, from bemoaning to organizing. And so I never want to miss a chance to offer our listeners models for taking that defining step. And with that in mind, what spurred you to action?
It's a great question. I looked around and I felt a need for something. I'd felt it throughout the 2016 presidential election, primaries, general election. I felt it in what I saw on social media, in conversations with people. And I didn't see it happening. And after the election, I saw that there was going to be no shortage of political opposition to the new president. And there was going to be, you know, no shortage of political support for the new president. And the question isn't whether those things are morally equivalent. The question is, what else is not happening? Like, what's not out there? And at the time, I felt compelled to do something about what I saw basically just as dangerous dynamics in our society. And I think later, as I started to work with experts and scientists, I started to understand those dynamics much better and realize just how dangerous they really are. But at the time, I was just concerned and wanted to do something positive, and was at a point in my career where I was looking to do something new, and I was really lucky to be able to turn it into a job for myself, but more importantly, to make the organization a reality.
And do you feel there were any habits or beliefs that at first held you back that if you had known about, you would have moved forward more quickly?
Yeah, I do. You know, I think everyone has enormous numbers of blind spots, frankly. I'm no exception. When I first started off, I used the word should a lot. You know, you should do this, we should do this, everyone should do this. And it was really Charlottesville, but also other just conversations I was having, where I really had to step back from that and say, no, that's not right. Not everybody feels able to do certain things. Not everybody should do certain things. There are ways to engage within your own group that can be positive, even if you never take a step towards a relationship with someone from a different group. Some people have experienced real, significant trauma in their lives that make it much harder for them to engage with certain groups of people who may have, that group of people may have been part of harming them in the past. I just got to a place where I realized that it did not dilute our message or our work at all to just acknowledge that not everything we do is for everybody, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. And I think if I'd realized that sooner, I think it would have helped early on, because I think a lot of people look at this work and say, you know, I have to choose between standing up for what I believe is right or bridging divides. And that's just not true. But it's certainly easier for people to see that that's not true when you don't come to them saying, here's what you should do. So that was a lesson, I think a humbling lesson that I learned early on in this work.
If you will, describe the people with whom you work. What kind of people are drawn toward what you're doing and want to be a part of it?
Yeah, I appreciate that. We have all sorts of people, and they're great. So, you know, our staff, we have someone who's, from the sort of evangelical Christian background. We have a Muslim staff member who was an intern in the Obama White House. We have an African-American woman who grew up in rural West Virginia. We have someone who belongs to a sort of liberal mainline church. So we really have who used to work for, in international development. So we have a really cool range of folks from very different backgrounds who all care about this work. Our board is the same way, and our project participants are the same way. So we have a lot of evangelical pastors, church members, et cetera. We have a lot of Jewish communities, Muslim communities, African-American church communities, just a range of folks who all want to see positive things happen in their community and are willing to work with people who are different than they are, who they may not have engaged with before, to do that work together.
Tell us what's in the works at One America Movement for the months ahead.
Yeah, absolutely. So we are, we've launched portals for chapters and for our religious leader training program. So if people want to start a chapter in their community, if they want to sign up to apply to become a part of our training program, they can do that on our website, oneamericamovement.org. We've got, the 11 chapters that we have that are active are continuing to hold events. Some of those will be happening in the months ahead. We're going to be launching a campaign around the 2020 election. We're still putting the last touches on it, so it's not public yet, but we'll be launching that and really promoting that over the next 6 months or so through the end of the election. And I think the other thing is just that, I think our new website being up, we're going to be a lot more active in terms of telling the story of the work that we're doing. So this trip to Puerto Rico that our Houston clergy are taking, telling the story about how, disasters affect all of us, different political, racial, religious groups, and that we need to work together to support each other and tell our politicians not to pit our communities against each other for funding and relief support and so forth, but to stand up for all of us. So we'll be telling those stories. We have a YouTube channel. We have our website, Facebook, Twitter, et cetera.
When you look at everything you have going on that you want to get done, and you also read the paper and see what gets covered more than anything else, do you look at the future hopefully or pessimistically?
I do look at it hopefully, and I it's not naive. I think that when you get out of the national news and you get out of Washington and you get into local communities, there is a lot more hope and a lot more functionality, if you will. I mean, I was in Ohio yesterday, or Tuesday, I'm sorry, speaking at an event. And we had Republican and Democratic politicians both there, supporting people who are joining the AmeriCorps program across that state. And there was such positive energy in the crowd of these young people who have dedicated a year of their lives to going out and serving their communities. They're not sitting around yelling at each other on Twitter. They're going out and doing something positive. And I think there's a lot more of that than we hear about in the news. The fact that we don't hear about it as much in the news is itself a problem that we have to address. But whenever I get out of Washington, I feel really hopeful.
Hmm. Tell our listeners how they can keep informed about what you're doing and how they can take part in what you're doing if they choose to do so, and how they can support, how everybody can support what you're doing.
Yeah, I appreciate that. Website is oneamericamovement.org, all spelled out. On our website, you can find our videos, our Facebook, our Twitter. You can sign up to start a chapter in your community, working with people from different backgrounds to do things that matter in your local community. You can sign up, as I said, to apply for our religious leader training program. Religious leader is not just clergy. It's a broader definition than that. And of course, you can donate as well. We have a link for that, unsurprisingly, on our website.
Andrew Hanauer is director of the One America Movement, which brings people of diverse backgrounds and beliefs together to build a movement for repairing and rising above our broken and divisive politics. And it's always inspiring to have you on. I really needed this today, and I'm sure that I'm far from being alone in that feeling. Thank you so much for taking time once again to be with us on State of Belief Radio.
Well, you're really kind, and I'm honored to be on again, and I'm happy to do it anytime.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, let me say a very sincere thank you. Your generous support of this program is vital to keeping us on the air. If you think there's value in what you've heard here, and you think it's important that others hear it as well, please make your contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Be part of the conversation. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to tune in next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. You'll hear Father James Martin, editor-at-large of America Magazine, on his recent private audience with Pope Francis at the Vatican. Jim is a longtime effective campaigner for more respectful church approaches toward LGBTQ persons of faith. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.